Okay, now Egypt's asking about healing and how that works. Now, this is not a matter of hermeneutics, in my opinion. All right, but I think there are a lot of Christian groups that set people up for being really, really, really disappointed because they'll imply that if enough people pray, it will get rid of the cancer or whatever this lump thing is. And I'd say I believe in the power of prayer, but I also believe that, you know, Paul begged God to take away his weakness several times, and God said, "No, I'm not going to do it. In fact, basically, I want you to have that weakness." And so I think praying in faith, absolutely, but praying in expectation or in testing God is a mistake. So you're mentioning about, is this a friend or a relative?
Relative, probably.
Yeah, that has what? Yeah.
He has like, I think it's kind of like overactive nerves like in his feet,
Yeah, okay.
and like you can see like some, he used to have like big knots on his neck for
All
some
right.
reason. I don't
Yeah,
know.
the exact details don't matter for the point. So the point is, people are saying we all need to pray and then God's going to heal him. How about we all need to pray and hoping that it's God's will that he be healed? But it's also equally likely, in fact, statistically, probably more than half likely, statistically, that God is allowing that disease to, you know, to exist. And, you know, and so I think praying in faith is one thing, but praying like putting God to the test, you know, is another. Okay. But then I think about the example of our sister Rosa, who prayed like ridiculously in faith about her husband, you know what I'm saying? And some of her friends, I think, kind of laughed at her a little bit, probably, honestly. And so I could go two ways on that. Because what if it had never happened? And what would that do to her faith? On the other hand, we have to honor her for her faith. So that's a tough road, I think, to walk down correctly. She was. And how can anybody falter in that? I think as long as in our heart we know if it's God's will.
So then, like, how do we avoid like praying to where we're feeling like we're or make it seem like we're testing God in a sense?
I think being presumptuous about it. So you know, I don't have the answer. I mean, praying with confidence, expecting, and there's the parable of the persistent widow, and there are passages like in 1 John, if you pray, it's according to God's will, it'll be done for you. I think finding a way somehow to pray with great confidence that if it's God's will, that it will happen, but also with humility, recognizing that God's will is may not be my will. And honestly, I don't think there's a formula you can apply there. I really don't think there is. I think I can look at somebody from the outside and go, that person is too far in this direction, and that person is too far in that direction. Probably the worst ability I would have to judge would be looking at myself on that, because we tend to be very biased about ourselves. Okay, now let's get back to this thing here. Rule number 16, which I think is the next to last rule, and it's in a there's a sense in which it is the last formal rule, which is rightly divide books by type of literature or by genre. And how we interpret different genres is a huge factor that leads to a lot of mistakes in interpretation. For example, poetry. How do we read poetry? Well, generally, what is a poet trying to do, just as a rule? What are they trying to create? An emotion, a feeling, a reaction, right? Something from a certain kind of music today, whatever. But, so an emotion, a feeling, a reaction. They're trying to express what they're feeling. They're trying to create a vision or an image in order to move you probably more of in an emotional direction than in a sort of intellectual direction. All right, so all of psalms, all, virtually all. There are a few psalms which are historical psalms, in which case they should be read as history. Okay? And there are a few messianic psalms which should be read as prophecy. But the majority of psalms is somebody pouring out their heart to God and trying to help us have a connection with God based on their personal connection with God. Most of it. Another poem is Song of Songs. All right? Which should be used to create an emotion or a feeling. Certainly not for doctrine. All right, reading psalms for doctrine is a huge error. It's a genre mistake. So David says in Psalm 51:4, against you, you only have I sinned. All right? So what's David trying to express here?
Remorse.
Yeah, I'm a wretched sinner. He could have said, I'm a wretched sinner, but he's writing poetry. And when you're writing poetry, you don't say, I'm a wretched sinner. You say things like, against you only have I sinned. Which, if you take it literally, means we only sin against God. You can't sin against somebody. The only sins are against God. The problem with that is, in the Jewish system, there was the sin offering and the guilt offering. And the guilt offering was for sins committed against another person. And it said before you make the guilt offering, you make restitution. When you do a sin offering, you don't make restitution, because how can you give restitution to God? All right? Or David said, I was a sinner. What did he say? In my mother's womb or something like that. Which proves original sin, right? Original sin that we inherit. No. He's saying, I'm just the worst, horrible sinner ever. Given what he'd done to Bathsheba, you know what? I think that was an appropriate feeling to have. All right, so people will often go to Psalms to prove all kinds of false doctrine. And so when they do that, just say, by the way, just, you know, that's poetry. That's poetry. Okay? Now, let's read Psalm 58:3. Psalm 58:3. By the way, Job is also poetry, and it's primarily poetry, and it should be read as poetry. By the way, just because something in the Bible is written in verse doesn't mean it's poetry. All right? In other words, often prophecy will be written down in verse format. All right? But you know, I'm defining a poem as somebody blurting out their emotions about, you know, the normal meaning of poem, which, you know, as you know, does not necessarily mean it rhymes and stuff like that. Okay. So Psalm 58, verse 3, which says, the wicked go astray from the womb, liars err from birth. All right. Now, my Bible says this psalm is a cry against injustice. So what's this person doing right here when he says the wicked go astray from the womb, liars err from birth? What's he saying? He's saying, God, there's lots of injustice out there. Now, what if Paul were to say this in Colossians chapter 3? The wicked go astray from the womb and liars err from birth. Well, he wouldn't say that in Colossians chapter 3. Because Colossians chapter 3 is, that's a theological and doctrinal saying. Got it?
What verse in chapter 3?
Psalm 58, verse 3. Even from birth, the wicked go astray. No, they don't. Babies are not sinning when they, you know, I don't know, whatever they do, they turn their head because they don't want to to get the food in their mouth or something like that. That's not a sin. Come on. Okay, what about Proverbs? A lot of mistakes are used, happen, I guess, when people try to use Proverbs. What is a proverb? It's a word of wisdom. And you have to understand, in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, God is speaking to people. But in Psalms and Proverbs, people are speaking to God or to each other. And if people are speaking to God, then that's not inspired generally. Mm-hmm. Now, the poem is inspired. The psalm is inspired. It's inspired to do the thing which it's intended to do, which is help us to have a connection with God. I'm not saying it's not inspired. What I'm saying is, you know, interpret it not as in doctrine. Okay? So, do not interpret things in Proverbs as promises. These are principles, and a principle is not the same thing as a promise. For example, in Proverbs 13:24, it says, "He who spares the rod spoils the child." Does that mean if you don't hit your child with a stick, you're spoiling them? No, because probably sparing the rod was an idiom anyway, which probably meant disciplining them. But exactly what it meant, whether it meant physical discipline or not, in the context, kind of hard for us to even know. All right? So I've heard this given as proof that we need to spank our kids. And if we don't spank our kids, we're not being good parents. You know, I guess you could argue that this passage gives us permission to spank our kids, I guess. I think I'd go that far. But to say that this means if we don't spank our kids, we're not doing a good job as parents, this is a proverb. Come on. This is a principle. And the principle is your children need firm discipline. Got it? Proverbs 22, verse 6. Here's another one which has been misused, teaching as if it's a promise. So, generally, we don't have doctrines or promises in Proverbs. Generally, what we have is rules of thumb. We have words of wisdom, which should be taken for what they're worth, which is as general principles that you would apply in whatever situation. So teach a youth about the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Okay, but this is a proverb. This is not a promise. And if you take this as a kind of like, you know, when God said to Abraham, you know, all nations will be blessed through you, that was a promise. And he said, you will inherit this land, that was a promise. He said, you're going to have children like the stars of the, you know, not, I guess not literally like, because there's 100 billion stars, but that was a promise. All right, so this is a principle. And what's the principle? In Proverbs 22, verse 6, well, that we should teach youth the way to go, and that will help them in the future to actually go that way. Is this a promise that every Christian will have all their kids converted to Christ? No, and if we take it that way, that's actually harmful. All right? So there is poetry. And there's different kinds of poetry. Even the different kinds of poetry should be taken for what they are. So proverbs are principles, but not promises or commands. You could take them as a command, but, you know, it talks about, you know, taking the ox out of their barn. So that's a command. That's one of the proverbs, by the way. And by the way, what it means is get to work, you know, be diligent in your work. All right, but what if you don't have an ox? How are you going to obey that one? Okay, I don't know anybody personally who has an ox. Okay, the next kind of literature is, proverb. Poetry, proverb, historical. So how should we interpret historical things? What we should do is we should interpret historical things as part of the picture of what God did. Right? We should always put the historical parts in the Bible in the picture of the story. of God choosing a person and a place and a people to whom to send the Messiah and all these things. We should also interpret them literally. In other words, if it says this person said that or did that, we should interpret that as meaning that this person said that or did that. Does that mean we have a transcript? So if you're reading Genesis 18, is this a transcript of the exact words that Abraham said? You know, I believe it's a faithful rendering of what he said. All right? But anyway. So 1 Corinthians 10:6, which says, you know, we should learn from them so that we would not make the mistakes that they made. So you read this history, they did this, it turned out bad. Well, then next time around, just don't do that. All right, so we have principles of how, you know, we have examples of what to do and what not to do and how God will react. So we find out what happened to Israel when they sinned. They got sent into exile. What's that tell you? That's not too hard to interpret. All right, but that does not necessarily mean that if you sin, you'll be sent into exile. Okay? So historical should be interpreted primarily to teach us examples about what we should or should not do, but also to give us a picture of how God works through history. Next is doctrinal. All right, and so doctrinal, such as Galatians or Romans or 1 Timothy, things like that. Okay, there are a number of doctrinal books. All right, Leviticus and Numbers are doctrinal books. And these we take very literally, but sometimes symbolically. You know, in other words, we take this to be God saying this is what you need to do or need to not do. All right, now what about the Gospels? The Gospels are hard to handle because they're a mixed genre. For example, John says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And then he says, the Word became flesh and dwelt for a while among us. We beheld his glory of the one and only Son. What kind of literature is that? I would call it doctrinal. All right, it's theology, it's doctrine. But then it says, Jesus went and talked to the woman at the well. That's historical. So Gospels, the genre of Gospels, the general genre of Gospels is history. Acts is history, and the Gospels are history. But you'll have long treatises within the Gospels, which are Jesus preaching. So that'll be doctrine. And you might even have some prophecy in there, as Jan mentioned. Okay? So the Gospels are hard to categorize, and they're a little bit problematic. They're a mixture of genre, primarily historical, all right, but also doctrinal and even maybe some prophecy. All right, next is apocalyptic. Okay. Apocalypsis, which means revealing, I believe, or unveiling. Right? The word apocalypsis means unveiling, which means sort of pulling back the curtain. So it's kind of looking at what's going on behind the scenes as opposed to what's going on in front. All right. Now, when you read apocalyptic literature, you should assume figurative unless the context demands literal. This is the exact opposite of normal language, where you assume things to be literal unless the context says it should be taken figuratively. So if it says the number 1,000 in Revelation and it says the number 1,000 in Acts, you take that quite differently, where Paul said that in 1 Corinthians 15, there were more than 500 witnesses. The reason he said that is because there were more than 500 witnesses, which means probably more than 500, but maybe less than 600, but certainly less than 1,000, right? But if you see the number 500, which by the way you would never, ever, ever see in Revelation, because the number 5 is not one of those symbolic numbers. So you'd never see 500. It wouldn't happen. And if there were 500, it wouldn't say 500. It might say 1,000. All right? So, in general, when you're reading apocalyptic language, you interpret it figuratively unless the context says to do different. So significant parts of Ezekiel, the whole last 8 chapters of Ezekiel, and the whole thing with the Valley of Dry Bones and Gog and Magog, not all of Ezekiel, but most of the last 13 or so chapters are apocalyptic. Daniel, the visions of Daniel are apocalyptic. Okay, Joel, almost all of Joel, almost all of Zechariah, and not all of Revelation, right? Not all of Revelation. You got those letters, chapters 2 and 3. Okay, got it? By the way, Acts 2, 17 through 21 is apocalyptic. Let's turn there. This gets me to the question of how do you know it's apocalyptic? Well, just read it. Acts 2, 17 through 21 is apocalyptic. So please, don't take it literally. You're going to make a fool of yourself. And believe me, people do all the time. On the internet, oh my goodness, it just drives me crazy. All right, verse 17, and it will be in the last days, says God, that I will pour out my spirit on all humanity. Then your sons and your daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams. I will even pour out my spirit on male and female slaves in those days, and they'll prophesy. I'll display wonders in the heaven. Here's how you know it's apocalyptic. I'll display wonders in the heaven above and signs in the earth below. Blood, fire, clouds of smoke. Sun will be turned to darkness. The moon to blood. This is your clear, absolute, 100% indication. This is apocalyptic. Okay? And basically, what it's announcing is the day of the Lord. There's this phrase used repeatedly in apocalyptic literature in the Old Testament. It talks about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is a day when God comes in judgment. And whenever you see the day of the Lord, all the language around that little thing is apocalyptic. And it's creating an image. Apocalyptic literature is very emotional. It's very visual. It's intended to give you an impression, a feeling. Okay? Zechariah 5:1. I picked this one, honestly, almost totally at random out of Zechariah, just as a way to remind you that Zechariah is not all apocalyptic. There is prophecy in Zechariah. The last like 5 chapters of Zechariah are prophecy, roughly 5. But the first like 7 or 8 chapters are apocalyptic. So I just picked this one almost at random. Zechariah 5, I looked up and saw a flying scroll. What do you see? He asked me. I see a flying scroll. He's really smart. Just say. I replied, 30 feet long and 15 feet wide. Wow, that's a big scroll. Maybe it's a drone. Maybe it's a drone. That's what our premillennial, it's a drone, you know, it's a tank, you know. Give me a break. Then he said to me, this is the curse that is going over the whole land. So what is this scroll? It's the curse that's going over the whole land. It's a pronouncement of the curse. So did he actually see a scroll in this vision? I guess so. Or something that's like a scroll. But it's got a symbolic meaning. And there's the horses in Zechariah, and the woman with the scale, and the golden lampstand, and the 4 horns, and the craftsmen, all apocalyptic. Generally, apocalyptic literature and language has to do with judgment, or with God coming to save his people. It's about great moments where God intervenes in history. Okay, got it? All right, Matthew 24:29. There's a little piece of apocalyptic literature in Matthew. Like I said, the Gospels are really tough. Most of the rest of the Bible, it'll be like one genre or at most two. All right? But the Gospels are potentially very confusing as to genre. Therefore, when we read the Gospels, we need to pay attention to genre and ask what's going on right here. So Matthew 24, I've got verse 29. It says, immediately after the tribulation in those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will be shed, will not shed its light. Okay, that is not going to happen literally. This is the day of the Lord. This is a day when God's going to come in judgment. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And when the city of Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD, the sun did not become darkened. The moon didn't stop shedding its light. And stars did not fall from the sky. Apocalyptic literature. All right, so we have apocalyptic literature in Matthew. And, All right, that might be enough on that. Revelation 24, the thousand-year reign, you know, the thousand-year, the millennium. Give me a break. Come on, it's not a thousand years. It's a long time. That's all it means. 144,000. That's 12 times 12 times 1,000. 12 means God's people. 12 apostles, 12 tribes. 12 times 12, 144, 1,000, many. And what does it say in the absolute next verse? It says, this is a great multitude that no one can count. Now, if it's a great multitude that no one can count, that means it's more than 144,000. Right? All right. The last thing is type, anti-type interpretation. You will not find this in any book. Because when I was writing my book, From Shadow to Reality, I had to create my own rules. I'm going to just read this real fast, because then we're going to have a presentation from our sister. All right? So this is there's a specific kind of literature, if you will, which is type, anti-type, prefigures, foreshadows. If a New Testament writer says a particular passage in the Old Testament is a foreshadow, then it is. So in John 3:14, it says, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so I will be lifted up. So he's saying, when Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, that's a prefigure or a foreshadow. All right. Also in Galatians 4, where he says, these things, Hagar, Sarah, etc., can be taken figuratively. And if he says that, that means it can be taken figuratively. All right. Number two, if an Old Testament passage works as a foreshadow, prefigure, whatever, both in the general sense and in the specifics, then it's probably legitimate. Which is why, even if Jesus hadn't said, just as Moses lifted up the snake, but it turns out it works in the general, which is people are going to die, they're getting saved. And then there's the specifics of the wooden thing there and the snake and the sin. So both the little details of the story and the big picture both work. All right? So a bad example would be that people say Rahab put a red thing on her door and she was saved. Say, that's a prefigure of the blood of Jesus. Oh, you know, okay, you know, but the problem is the story doesn't really fit. The detail fits, which is she put a red thing there and she wasn't killed. But the whole story, that doesn't seem to be the context of the story. So, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, but I wouldn't make a big deal out of it. All right, if one already knows the general event in the Old Testament is a foreshadow, then it's safer to assume the details are foreshadows. For example, in Genesis 22, take your son, your only son. All right, that's clearly about the Jesus. So therefore, And if I see that, I can start picking that story apart to the smallest possible detail, because God just does that on a regular basis. So the fact that it was on the third day, the fact that that Isaac carried the wood up the thing, all those things. All right, good. So now we are going to have a little thing from Galatians what?
Three.
Galatians 3. Let's all turn there. I'm going to sit down. And I can tell you decided to go from there. Just speak fairly loudly for the rest of us. And that's just kind of near you.
All right, it's near me. Okay, well, you know, I started reading Galatians and looked into that. It was written by Paul in 49 A.D. It was written to the church in southern Galatia, which is part of Asia. And kind of the crux of the first part of Galatians was that he was speaking to Christians who were turning away from the faith. Something said they were bewitched into regression by the Judaizers. Is that right?
Yep, Judaizers.
Judaizers, and that who said that the Christians must follow the Jewish law to be saved. So when I got to Galatians 3:10, for all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse, as it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. And that just, to me, that seemed contradictory, just in that one, those two sentences. It says you were, for all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse. Cursed is everyone who does not continue to do everything written in the book of the law. And that kind of, again, taking it back into context, I don't know if I'm going to say this right.
Right, so in other words, here's what I'm hearing from you. On the one hand, saying, if you're relying on the works of the law, you're cursed. And then immediately after he says, but you need to rely on the works of the law, otherwise you will be...
Yeah.
Right. So that's the possible confusion there, right?
Yeah.
Great.
So, but then again, as I went back and looked at the fact that they were being led astray, saying, I want, you know, you have to follow the Jewish law, and the overall theme of the book being that, no, we're saved because Jesus came and died for us, and that law no longer stands. I don't know. And then I had a better understanding of it, and that's kind of where I stopped. I thought, okay, I got it. Does that make sense?
I think you're very accurate. Yes, thank you. In other words, the bottom line is the righteous will live by faith.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why we cannot rely on works of the law. And so the question is, how is he using his quote from, is that Leviticus? Is he quoted from Leviticus? Deuteronomy. Right, so the question is, how is he using Deuteronomy? He's using it kind of ironically, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's saying, if you want to go by that one, go for it, but good luck with that one, essentially, right? Because it says it right there in the Bible, right?
Yeah, and if you go back before, no, this is after. Clearly, no one who relies on the law is justified before God, because the righteous will live by faith. So,
yeah.
Maybe I was too narrow in just looking at that one section, but like when I read it, it was kind of, it looked contradictory to me. So.
I think what you're doing is you're allowing this writer's interpretation to stand. In other words, what's the interpretation of his use of cursed everyone who does not continue to have written the book of law. And basically Paul says, here's how I'm to interpret that. In verse 11, you're allowing 11 to explain 10. I think that's what you're doing.
Yeah, I think so.
Because in 11 it says, it is clear that no one is justified before God by the law. So therefore, the prior statement of about cursing everyone who does not do it, in other words, that is not a statement about how people actually get justified. It's really a statement about how they don't get justified. That's how I'm interpreting what you're saying. I think you hit it, you know, you may not be putting beautiful sentences together, but I think you're interpreting exactly correct. So, the bottom line is, you could say that Galatians 3:11 is a theme verse for the entire book of Galatians, couldn't you?
Yeah, I also looked at Galatians 5:1, which is, it is for freedom that Christ has
right.
set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened by the yoke of slavery, which is the law.
Slavery to the law.
Yeah.
Right? In fact, I think I might have mentioned in a different context, he's talking about slavery not to sin. He's talking about slavery to the law. And how do I know that? Because of the context. For example, because of the context of Galatians 3:10-11. Good. Yeah, and so the entire theme of Galatians is salvation by the law or salvation by the Spirit. Which is it?
Spirit.
By the Spirit. So there you go. Thank you. I think you hit it pretty well.
Thank you.
So did I end at least a couple minutes early as promised? Probably not.
10:46.
Oh, 10:46.
10:46? No.
That's right.
Well, I'm really, really, really on time, which is a shock. So we'll leave it at that. Thanks, everybody. I hope this is helpful. I hope you'll kind of, these rules, you, as you use them, is when you'll really learn them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I got a follow-up on Twitter by Tyler 6424.